Hello, and welcome to Educational Triage, where we discuss issues in alternative education. This is a discussion about teaching by teachers, for teachers, and others who are interested in the alternative education world. We hope you find today's episode relevant, engaging, and useful. And if you do, please subscribe. I'm Tony Hunt, and I'm here to help guide you with the help of my friends Christy and Philip. That really points things out. One word of interest, I suppose, is that I went through and I read a lot of the reviews of this book too. And a lot of people said, well, he just points out the same things that we've known for a long time. Well, yeah, but he also comes up with solutions and he asks the right kinds of questions. And if he's seeing it as a student and we are the adults in the room and you know that these things are wrong, what have you done about it? Have you done anything? So why don't we just get cracking and take a look and see what our thoughts are on the book. Who wants to go first? Christy? You said that you were just like a coloring book. You were marking in so many different colors throughout the entire thing on your Kindle.
Yeah. What? I just kept going, and then I finally realized, like, oh, my gosh, my whole, like, you can't see it if you're listening to the podcast, but it's like, there's just so much color on here. It is. And then I realized I'm just coloring the whole book, and so I just need to stop doing that. It's super interesting, I thought, because from – so many times we go to workshops and trainings and symposiums and all sorts of gatherings to make us better teachers. And I would say 95% of the time it's all by fellow teachers. And so it was really interesting to hear or to read all these statements from the kids' perspective. And it was very well written. And you're right, he did give lots, like, historical background, and then he gave lots of information. But it kind of, the parts that really, the first part where he was saying the skills that should be taught in school aren't there, the 21st century skills, and we've talked about that in previous podcasts, about what are employers looking for? Are we teachers preparing students with these 21st century skills that they have to have in order to be successful in their jobs and in the community and the technology and the job world that we live in? And so I just loved all his examples. He talked about the four C's, which was the critical thinking, creative thinking, collaborative, and communication. And then he added some more in. And I thought those were, I have to keep scrolling through all my highlighting. And, like, you know, curiosity. And, you know, it was just kind of sad that he was saying that, you know, by the time they get to high school, curiosity is just basically beaten out of kids. Not physically, but, like, you're super curious. Right? Like, if you're a four-year-old, you ask your parents questions nonstop. Are we there yet? Why does the dog bark? Why is this fur? Why is the sky blue? And you just keep asking and asking and asking. And then he said, when kids are fully assimilated into kindergarten, they've already learned that teachers value the correct answer. So you're not asking to gain knowledge. You are just spitting out an answer that the teacher wants. Mm-hmm. And that just is so, it's heartbreaking. And it's so true. Right?
And, right. And if you think about, and if you think about these parents that go searching for the correct school, what school am I going to get my kid in? My kid has to be in the right school. Mm. And my God, you're taking the kid's childhood away, first of all, and you're already promoting, I guess, clonism. Where you just want them to be like these little automatons that can't think for themselves, that have to just, you know, fall into line. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, the aspiration to be curious, to have that curiosity continue into high school, which is the level that we tend to teach. You know, we're not, the kids will just wait there. What are we supposed to learn? As opposed to, like, what could we learn, right? Where is that curiosity? And it's not there. They're just waiting for us to just take spoon and then feed them. And I love that other question that they did where one of the a mom was saying, like, instead of asking my kid when they came home today, like, did you have a good day today? Did you have fun today? Instead, she asked the question, did you ask a good question today? Like, the questions are what make you become better and more knowledgeable. Did you ask a good question today? I'm like, oh, that's great. I love it.
Yeah, hey, you know, I was thinking
on that one as to whether or not. Go ahead, Philip.
Oh, I was just thinking meta over the whole thing, and it occurred to me I think I heard Foucault say once. It's probably Michel Foucault, and I don't want to name drop the guy, but he said something like, "After all, what's the value of knowledge if it's only for some of the knowledgeable?" And to keep to themselves. And then I think he added, sometimes the questions in life are not so much thinking about them the same way, but perceiving them differently and seeing things in a way it's absolutely necessary to look at them and reflect on them in a different way that it's ever been done before. And so I've got to thinking about all that. And then when it was related to the book was sort of, that was from the mouths of babes. It was said, you know, even back then, it's not modern knowledge attainment. It's sort of the same structured sort of system that's putting forth these people. And what we need is thinking people, you know, not knowledge for the sake of a few knowledgeable in the base that we set it up in, but, you know, the ability to keep being curious. You know, and to feed that, and to fail, right? That thing you talked about, that failure to go forward and not fear failure, because after all, failure is the process by which we succeed.
Right. And I agree. My other question is, that goes along with that, why are we so afraid to change things up for students? What is it? Why do we have to be so focused? And as he says, let me find it here. Oh, here. I had this preconceived notion that good test scores equaled intelligence. Mm-hmm. It all equals intelligence. How'd you do on your SATs? Well, I scored a 1080. Well, I got a 1400, so I must be smarter than you. Well, you can study for the SATs. You can have other people take the SATs for you, too. I mean, it's been done. And it doesn't really prove a whole lot. It just means that you test better.
Right.
But and he says, no, this is not the case. That does not prove your intelligence. Because how many people do you know who had the highest GPAs at your high school who are thriving out in the world right now and doing gangbusters and really burning the world down? Not literally. But, you know, they just, you know, they have so much. And I remember I was speaking to this one classmate of mine from high school, and I was asking him, because I fell out of touch. I moved around a lot as a kid, and even as an adult, I've moved. And I said, well, whatever happened to these people? And he said, well, you remember so-and-so who didn't do that well academically. Well, he's a millionaire several times over because of X, Y, and Z. And I know another kid who wasn't what I would call a genius, and yet he is one of the wealthiest people in his state. And he started out dirt poor. And how was it that they were able to do it? It's because they were not told that they were smart, because we know that that hinders kids, because they think that they're smart, so they don't have to try as hard. They know that they're looking for something so that they can survive. They're looking for a way just to do the best that they can. And the work ethic that they have developed in order to be able to get to where they need to be is far higher than the people who are told that they're much more intelligent, the one for whom tests are easy, the ones who can figure things out, because they've never really had to try so hard and their struggle is less. And so I've always thought to myself, and this is before I even saw the data on all this, what, or the research, was I wonder if the reason why this guy went so far and got so much further ahead than I did was because his life had all these struggles that he had to get through, and that taught him that he needed to do that. And I thought, you know, struggling is actually a privilege.
Yeah. Well, and it helps develop resilience and perseverance and persistence, and that, you know, that get up and try it again kind of thing that is we want in people, right? We don't want, you don't want an employee to be like, I don't know how to work this machine. Oh, well, not going to try anymore, right? Like, you need someone to keep at it and try and figure out and do all the things like you were describing with that person, that they keep. So they're developing those skills that we are saying we need.
That's an underlying successful philosophy amongst excellent people in history and even now the world over. The SEALs use the process, embracing the suck. You know, they move forward with that feeling. You know, the only easy day was yesterday, they say. You know, you just keep moving forward, and through each evolution, you take it in bite-sized pieces, and it's a really amazing way to move through life. And that's the kind of thing that I was trying to teach the kids too. We were using breathing exercises and analyzing like handfuls of sand, you know, just looking into them and sort of emptying our minds of everything but what we were looking at, and that's dipping right into like Buddhism. And then, like, if you want to get technical with the kids, you go, the Shaolin warriors use this too, you know, the Kung Fu monks and such. But it's the truth, and it's the focus. It's the wisdom. And it's interesting stuff, but it all comes from that interested learning, inquisitive curiosity, what you're talking about, what we're all talking about. And it doesn't matter what you do, whether you're practicing piano, playing soccer, doing math equations. If you're into it, man, you're into it. And you can approach learning like that. And it doesn't all have to be done by the bell schedules and such, or to the lowest common denominator of the standards. Right. You can actually one kid take off and one kid kind of sit on the coattails and learn as they go. And then the rest of the class kind of make a celebration or a dirge out of it, whatever you prefer, but, you know, make it a human experience and not just an artificial 9-week experience.
Yeah. Part of me is wondering when we will get somebody who has the cojones, male, female, or whatever, to actually change this concept as a superintendent or as a principal or whatever, and they will throw out this regimented system that we have where, and I was thinking about this today, Andrew Jackson, who really pushed for this educational system originally, he was also the one who broke the created the treaties and the reservations, and then broke the treaties with the natives, with the aboriginals of the U.S. And that kind of tells you that says a lot about his way of thinking. You know, if he could treat other human beings that way, and think of this, he's treating our children, and I can't say that they're both on an equal level. They're both not on equal footing, but he's. To do something like this is, I don't know, it says something about a person that they would want the kids there, but it was a different time and a different culture. But today we have people asking, where did curiosity go? Why aren't kids curious anymore? And yeah, we can say, well, we have Google, we have this, we have that. But still, I mean, do you ever find yourself just sitting there and daydreaming and thinking about something that you have to Google it because you're curious about it, and then you do a little bit more digging?
Yeah.
Where I see a lot of kids who you ask them a question, they Google it, and that's it. That's the end of the conversation. And I have parents who ask me these things, and they said, well, what are you doing to help foster creativity and curiosity? And I said, well, I think a lot of that has to start under your roof rather than in my classroom, because we can encourage it, but they only have me for a certain amount of time. Right. Even if I had them for all 6 hours of the day, you have them for 18. So let's get on board, bucko. And I think it starts at a very early age when we teach kids to be creative. And I think creativity teaches curiosity, because you have to be creative with your thought and your mind. But getting back to what I was originally going to say, I know it's a little roundabout. I just love going down rabbit holes. I might catch a rabbit, which I saw in my front. Okay, I'll stop. No, but if they would get rid of the bell schedule, and if they would get rid of 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, and they would put kids into groupings by what they needed to learn or what they wanted to learn. And so let's say that we have auto shop. Well, what kinds of math do you need for auto shop? You have to have some for measurement. You have to have some in order to do some kind of modifications on automobiles. If you're going to rebuild an engine, don't you have to bore? I mean, all these things all come together. If you're going to do artwork, how do you know if you have to do something to scale? How do you figure out the scale of what it is that you're doing? You know, architecture uses a lot of math, and it has drawing and CAD. Requires imagination, mathematics, and technology. You think about history, well, unfortunately, there are no real common core skills that are associated with the social sciences. There just aren't. You either know it or you don't. But are you going to take what that person in the front of the room tells you happened, or are you going to research it? And I learned about that when I was in high school, because my history teacher showed us a movie while we were talking about the cavalry and the natives and everything like that. And he showed us this movie and it blew me away. And I was really upset by it. I was at a debate tournament and I bumped into my former history teacher, and he said, "Well, how do you like history this year in a new school?" And I told him, and he said, "Oh, dude, that movie is so off base. Let me give you some resources. You'll look at them. Go to the library and look at them," because we didn't have internet back then.
Well, now I'm curious about what movie it was. Do you remember?
Yeah, I'll tell you later.
Okay. See, I'm curious. Like, now I'm just like, what movies you talk about? Have I seen that movie? I'm super interested.
And, you know, and I saw, and I read, and I saw the history on what happened. And then he had us read a book, and it was a very political book at the time. And I read through the book, and now I had a jaundiced eye, and I wrote an essay that just pummeled him for force-feeding us what I considered to be a lot of BS. And I kind of went with it, and I used logic and reason as best as I could. And a very good friend of mine read the paper, because I had to go off to another debate tournament. And he said, "I'm not turning this in." I said, "Why not?" He said, "He will kill you." Because this guy used to pick kids up by their desks and throw them.
Oh,
and he said, "I don't want to see you hurt." And I said, "Just turn it in. He's not going to kill me." And when I came back, he handed back the papers, and he said there was only one A in this entire classroom, because only one person had the balls to tell me what he thought. Everybody's looking around saying, "Who was it?" Well, yeah. And I had no idea. I was terrified. And he called out my name, and I thought, whoa. And I went up to him and I talked to him, and he said, "No." He said, "You actually opened my eyes, and thank you for your opinion." And that opened my eyes as far as how I need to be teaching social studies and history when I teach it, that I have to keep an open mind and listen to everybody's views, because when we read a text, we're looking at somebody else's perspective on it and their bias. Mm-hmm. And when we hear it from a teacher, we also hear that. So how are we, bringing this back into a nutshell, how are we encouraging that kind of thinking, divergent thinking, creative thinking in our classroom?
We do it by example, I think.
That's the question.
I was just listening to you speak and identifying with what you were saying, and I was actively listening, and I was picking out things from what you were saying and the intention of learning from you something to enlighten me with a new approach. And by doing so, I was modeling that, although I am alone. And I think to myself, that's a behavior that I like. And if I'm in a classroom, if I'm around kids and students or other adults, I model that behavior. I should model that behavior. And so that's the first thing you do. And that's that fake it till you make it. So if you're modeling that behavior, then even if you're not engaged in that behavior, it sort of starts to have the information received in that mode. It's all a matter of perception. Can you perceive things from outside yourself? Do you see things from a perspective of yourself or the I, and then we, you and I, and then the thing we're talking about? Can you separate them all? Can you look at them subjectively and objectively and together with another person doing those things? Can you operate that way? And that's perception, and it's more difficult than it sounds. And we teach those things to kids through behavior, and we have to explicitly sometimes explain that's how the world is better perceived.
But how do we encourage the kids to do that? Right, we do it through modeling. And what he says is get rid of grades, get rid of grade levels.
Yeah.
And encourage the students to learn by what they want to learn. Well, I want to learn about cars. Well, okay, fine. So then we're going to go down this path, and we're going to create this this thing for you has the math based on it. We can do history with that, but you still have to have a bit more American history or whatever history that your world history. And you have to have an understanding of that, because history tends to repeat itself for those who aren't paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
And and then once you get rid of grades and you have the students present their portfolios of their work, because if I can sit down with you and I can explain what I've learned in this class, or I can do a project that demonstrates what I've learned in this class, that's a completely different kind of assessment. Why does everything have to be gauged through tests? Why does the state demand that we do that? And we have legislators, we have policymakers who they believe that they understand teachers and they understand school because they once went to school. By God, I should become president because I see him every day on the television set.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I know what it is to be a president. Because I have been one of the people who's like rotting here in this jungle under their thumb. So that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, right? I mean, if you're a parent, you know that even though your parents raised you one way and you say,
right,
I will not raise my child the same way, and then you discover that you do, or you go completely off the rails and go the other direction, which is just as bad, because then you start appreciating your parents and what they taught you, and you start to see the benefits of what it was, of what those were.
But just because I was a child doesn't mean every person's going to be an expert parent, or, you know, just because I watch Grey's Anatomy and MASH doesn't mean like I'm a surgeon now, right? Like, you know, just because you have been a part or a witness of it doesn't mean you're going to be successful at it.
Right.
For sure.
Although I did watch the original MacGyver, so I have a totally great skill set.
Yeah. Right. Using a paperclip and a rubber band, and I can build a car.
Not the new schlocky one. But yeah, so why don't we have teachers who are, and I hate to say elected by teachers because teachers get so political and they miss the mark because it's not about the kids. I'm going to go out on a limb here and I'm going to say unions really don't care about the kids. It's about they're doing their job. They're doing the bargaining for their members, but they are not there for the students. And I wish they would quit lying and saying that they're there for the students. No, they're there for the teachers, and that's what they're there for. Who is there to advocate for those students? We certainly don't have it in Congress. We certainly don't have it at the state level. We certainly don't have it at the regional level either, because we have policymakers who are more into optics. We have policymakers who are more into saying things and then not putting everything behind it. And I think one of the most dangerous phrases that school districts say, and I think that people need to start taking action on this and maybe then they'll get their acting gear, is mm-hmm. We will educate every child. We will educate every student. That's their goal. And yet they fall short of that and they don't really care.
Do need to be, I mean, that's our focus, right? But you don't want it to be like, we're doing it for at like the state level, like it's happening. Right. Is that what you're saying? Cause I'm like, we should be trying to educate every.
We should be, but yeah. I don't, but here's the thing. Who are the kids who aren't educated in the mainstream classroom? Our kids, the ones who go into alternative education.
Right.
And then they sit there and they toss them over there and then they forget about them. And then they take away a number of privileges. They do all kinds of things. They mandate that they all have to be on computers. They mandate, because for some reason or other, they feel that they still have to control. And by God, that kid didn't learn when we gave them the chance, and we are going to punish the heck out of them.
It does get frustrating that if a student doesn't succeed in this box, they have to do the exact same thing when I put them in another box. And that's been super frustrating. Like we've done it time and time again where a kid didn't, you know, they may have learned 3/4 of their history class, but because they didn't demonstrate knowledge of 1/4 of it, right? So they fail. So then you have to take the whole thing over again. And you're like, but they mastered 3/4 of it. They should just only have to do this 1/4 so that they can graduate, like
fill in all the right boxes.
And so we have to, it's that quote. I mean, we even had it on our notes today. If we teach today as we taught yesterday, we rob our children of tomorrow. So if I'm going to teach them exactly the same way.
Right. That was John Dewey.
John Dewey. Yeah. And it's still applicable. If we do it the exact same way and we're going to do it today, just like we did yesterday, and then it's not working, but we're going to keep doing it. Right? I'm going to put them in a different spot. I'm going to put them in special ed. I'm going to put them in alt ed. We're going to put them in a smaller class size, but we're going to teach the exact same way. And lo and behold,
stuck in a horrible feedback loop.
Yeah, you're in this loop. And so we have, we've got to, change how we grade, or you change what we're teaching them, or like the just sheer quantity, right?
Change
like,
what we that's teach, another one not that was in how there we that, teach.
And how much we're teaching. Like, I remember in college, right? Like, you were cramming for finals. And as soon as I took the test, you were just piling so much information in so much in a short little span that you couldn't really get into the depths to remember all of it. And I think we do that with a lot of our students, right? You have 8 classes. You're going to have, right? You're going to be in, we all have finals at the exact same time. So you got to demonstrate mastery. For 8 classes, unless you've got an elective,
I
think one of the points he makes is how do they demonstrate the mastery?
Exactly. Yeah. Do they all need to be doing it at the exact same time for 90 minutes on a Scantron, right? Like, that's not how it should be.
Yeah. Look at me. I graduated from high school and I can fill in a bubble.
So if I'm I remember friends who, I'm sure we've all had those friends that were either book smart or street smart. Remember, you kind of use that phrase, but sometimes they weren't, they didn't have strengths in both.
What an odd world it is, like, that with all the adults stopping every now and again and freaking out all together, going, boy, I got finals together. I got finals this Friday, Ned. How about you? Yeah, Jill and I are really studying for them. Yeah, at work, we've got four finals, and I'm cramming like crazy so I can forget it by Monday and get, you know. It's like, what? That's not life. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Oh, it's not. It's not like that. Not like that at all.
No. Right. So let me read two quotes to you from the book. And they're both quoting somebody else. The first one is Woodrow Wilson in 1909. And remember, Woodrow Wilson was the paragon of virtue with the progressives until he wasn't, because somebody pointed out some very racial
horrifying
shenanigans that he was involved in, which were well known until recently, and they just kind of batted away. But anyway, when he was president of Princeton University, he declared, "We want one class of persons to have a liberal education, and we want another class of persons, a very much larger class of necessity in every society, to forego the privileges of a liberal education and fit themselves to perform specific, difficult, manual tasks." So, there's an elitism, and I believe that that is still permeating, where you have the universities are becoming more and more and more expensive.
Yeah.
And then we also hear people who go to a university, and my viewpoint of university, and he says this in the book as well, that it doesn't matter what university you went to. It depends on the education you got and how you use that education and where it takes you as an individual. But we have all these people now who say, oh, you went to that school. Well, you're not good enough. And so we've created a culture of elitism that everybody seems to buy into. So if let's say that you went to University of Oregon and somebody else went to Harvard, you may have had the same level of education. You might not have had the same... It may not have been as difficult to get into University of Oregon, despite all the jokes I make about it. but the thing is that it's what you it depends on how you use the information that was given to you and how you can deploy that after graduation. Otherwise, it's the difference of tens of thousands of dollars that you're in debt, or maybe not, depends on your family and scholarships and whatever.
Right.
But how are you deploying that in education into the real world? It doesn't matter a hill of beans. If I'd gone to Yale and studied there, or Harvard, or the University of Washington, or UCLA, it wouldn't really matter, because would I still end up in the same place? I don't know, because each one of those places would have their own wealth of opportunities. So I think we need to look at what we're given and how we can use that without forcing people to want to have the most expensive and what is qualified as the best by an elite few.
Right.
Did I make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. That made sense. Right. There's all these...
Yeah, that made sense from a standpoint of, except for going to a Harvard or a Yale does put you in a network that you definitely want to be in. A lot of people are groomed through a series of prep schools to go to Harvard or Yale, and then, you know, their career paths are sort of slotted from there. Although there are some people that break away from that, and there's some amazing opportunities there. There is a sort of a East Coast sort of groove and a West Coast sort of groove when it comes to elite universities. But generally speaking, I agree with you. Yeah, it's what you do with the education after you get out of the university. I've had very few people ask me where I went to school, and I don't generally mention it. So, yeah.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you on the network, because depending on what university you go to, there is a network. If you know how to employ it. Just because there is a network doesn't mean that everybody gets into the network. And just because they're a smaller school. Smaller schools do have incredibly vibrant networks of outreach where people are able to find jobs. My brothers went to small universities and they still stay in touch with a lot of their mentors. Well, the one, well, I guess only one of them's alive, but when they were alive, they still kept in touch with those. And it helped provide them with a huge level of influence. And we're talking Seattle University, Northwestern University, and University of Portland. And I almost went to Dartmouth. So, you know, I decided it was too far. But you can get into a network because every department has its own. And if you work hard enough, you can get there. I had a student who begged me to find her a way to become a doctor without use of science or math. And I said, oh, sweetie.
Wait, what?
Good luck. Yeah. I said, you know, I love you to death, but I don't know. I'll look into it, but I really don't know. And I had somebody castigate me because I took away her dream. And I said, well, I really can't think of a way to be a doctor, a pediatrician, without use of science or math.
Yeah.
So, well, guess what happened? All of a sudden, that information became relevant when she went away to school. And she went to a good university. And originally, she was not that sure of herself. And she went to university. She surprised herself. And she got into these science classes and realized, hey, these things are starting to make sense. So she did do science and she was doing math. And I'm sorry about the heavy panting. That's Autumn. And
little puppy.
Yeah, she's decided to come visit my leg and lick it to death.
Our mascot.
yeah. But anyway, so she ended up working in the School of Optometry. And she told me, she said, I figured out how to do it. And I got top honors in research at my school. And she said, what do you think of that? And I said, I couldn't be prouder.
Yeah.
I said, this is fantastic. So I think that if, you know, she had a dream that she wanted to do something medically, she ended up doing something medically. She's doing something completely different now. She's already published at least one book and she's doing other things because she loves writing. But she got to hit her dream, but she never quit. She kept looking for other opportunities to teach her and get her there. So, and that had nothing to do maybe with the university, except it was a small university. So, and this is another topic that we wanted to talk about, which was security of failure.
Yeah.
The opportunity of failure, which needs to happen.
Yeah, that's critical. That's such a good, failure is looked as, you know, avoid at all costs and says something about, like, if you can't accomplish a task, it's therefore representative of, like, every part of your being, right? And so, and then that's, we've talked about it before, like, that's how Alt-Ed is sometimes viewed. And he mentions it in here, too, like, if you fail, you should go to Alt-Ed, and that's where you go to try and, like, figure stuff out. And so it's seen as a less than or as a punishment, right? Rather than as a positive experience or an opportunity. But I mean, every inventor you've ever, you know, you research have all said, you know, Edison, I didn't fail 10,000 times. I just figured out 10,000 ways that a light bulb didn't work, right? Like if you look at it that way. Or the Michael Jordan quote, for every so-and-so amount of games I won, I lost this many, right? I've even been watching the another, like the Elizabeth Holmes, she's in the news again because she was the one who did that. She created that huge business Theranos where she was creating a machine that could test your blood, but she didn't quite present it to investors as accurately as possible. But that was the whole big mantra of her business. Like we don't fail. Like we don't say that it's not working. It's always working. So that was that that environment, and then people would just freaked out if something wasn't working. Like, shh, just don't say anything,
the,
right?
The thing about her is that she didn't accept reality. I like to look at Virgil Gus Grissom had this take on the controls of one of the Mercury capsules in the early days of NASA, and that it was like flying a just basically this primitive thing into space, but he wanted control of it. And they said, well, we have autopilot. And he said, well, I want control even, you know, as it goes up. And they said, well, what are you going to do? It's probably going to crash. He goes, yeah, well, it'll give me something to do before I hit.
And being in control of what it does, right? That's a big, having ownership of it. And that was the quotes from the book too. Like, we, children aren't afraid to fail. It's society that implants this fear. But if you have a process of experimentation, that's when the true innovations blossom. And by that happens all the time in our classes. If you let the, you don't spoon feed them the answer, they try and figure it out. They may get it wrong. But, you know, there's all these times in your childhood looking back where you're like, oh, I didn't get this interview. I can totally remember when I crashed my bike, when I learned how to ride a bike. Right, you remember mm-hmm. those things, those moments that kind of that you kept going and you kept pushing on, and those are those moments that are valuable. And so we have to embrace the failure with our students. It's okay. Like, not every kid is guaranteed to succeed 100% of the time. That's we're not doing our jobs. Not. It shouldn't. Right. But there's this mantra of like, oh my gosh, my kid is getting a 93%. What's wrong? And you're like, wow, that's really good. Like, you should be celebrating, you know.
Almost an A minus.
Look at any sort of bad grade or, yeah, right, boo. You know, we've just turned this into, like, you have to. And, you know, the social media, like, I don't put all my gross pictures up on social media. You get them super pretty and you Photoshop them and you make them look all shiny and cutie pie, right? And so we present ourselves as we know what we're doing and we're being successful. And that's, I think, what our schools are doing, too. We promote what is really working well rather than promoting risk taker.
Do we promote what's working well, or are we promoting what's comfortable for us at the moment and doing what we're told to do?
Latter.
I think educational systems are trying to promote that we're doing all that we can for every student so that everyone can succeed. I don't think that's not happening.
I think we like to pat ourselves on the back and say that we are. So let me throw this out. A common argument, this is a quote from the book, common argument I'm presented with is that a person with a bachelor's degree will earn 84% more over a lifetime than a person with only a high school diploma. As former U.S. Secretary of Education William Bennett writes for CNN, an online salary ranking system called payscale.com calculates a student's 30-year return on investment at the top 1,300 colleges nationwide based on average alumni salary and tuition costs. Their recently issued 2012 report suggests that out of the 4,500 colleges and university in the nation, only the top 800 to 850 give you an annual return on investment greater than 4%. In pure financial terms, students might be better off investing their tuition money in stocks rather than 4 years with one of our nation's many colleges. And then another quote where they say, you know what? The mission of college education is for you to learn. It's not doing its job. And so if you have to learn, well, find out what the textbooks are, go down to the library, check them out, and save yourself $200,000 and just get the books for free and read them and teach yourself. I mean, seriously, because universities are to explore and teach you, but it's also most of the time, let's say that you received a degree in business and marketing. Well, when you get your first job, what's the first thing you're going to do? They're going to train you how to do business and marketing because you didn't learn that at university. So you learned some of the concepts, but maybe you didn't learn the right concepts. Yeah. And every business is going to do it differently. So Maybe university should be 2 years and then have their own internships. Mm-hmm. Why not? And that way students can learn that way. I don't know. I'm just throwing things out there. There's another, okay, and I want to throw out this one because I love this. These two quotes. One is, it is the acts that make us extraordinary, not the Oprah moments. Mm-hmm. So when we practice and when we're doing the dirty work and we're doing all that stuff, maybe we're interviewed by Oprah as a superstar, but we've been working really hard before right. that. And then the Eartha Kitt quote, which is, I am learning all the time. The tombstone will be my diploma. And he says, be immersed in the chaos.
Yeah.
Here, here.
Because every waking moment is a learning moment. It's a teachable moment. I love that quote.
Here we are.
Yeah, those are, and I think the Oprah moment kind of goes back to the embracing the failure, right? It's not, it's all the hard work and the, and the grind, right? It takes a while to get, to reach your goals. It's not quick. And I think that's becoming, I think, harder for a lot of our current students. And, you know, everything's just faster and more immediate right now. So it is harder to say, like, yeah, you're going to have to take a full semester to write, to do all this research about something you're really excited about because there's so much to learn. And, you know, it's not just one, like, Google Wikipedia page.
Mm-hmm. Do today what others won't, so, do tomorrow what others can't.
Yes. Mm. That's a great one. So, wrapping up, what was your biggest take on the book?
It was that, the connection between the past and the present and how they haven't changed with the approach to education.
Right.
Right.
The educational right. system has not changed with the environment and society around it. Uh-huh. We're still doing the same things and the same style with the same calendar that we were doing decades prior.
Yeah. And we're not doing it as effectively, I don't think.
Right.
And our kids, and just, and I don't think our students are learning anymore. And I wouldn't say, you know, people say, well, they're the most informed, but that doesn't mean that they retain.
Mm-hmm.
So my grandfather and my grandmother used to walk around quoting Shakespeare. They used to quote great poets and authors and whatnot. My brother went around quoting the Greeks and the Romans because he studied intellectual history, and he just loved that stuff. And I don't know that we have that many people who are completely into, you know, just the love of knowledge and love of learning and understanding and paying attention to all that was there. Mm-hmm. And applying it. So as once we did.
Well, that's that quote. You put, I think we all highlighted that quote, like from H.L. Mencken. Yeah. And like from 1924. I mean, it's just exactly what you just said. The aim of public education is now not to fill the young of the species with knowledge and awaken their intelligence. Nothing's further from the truth. You reduce as many individuals as possible to the same safe level, breed and train a standardized citizenry, put down dissent and originality. And that was 1924. And we're still kind of the same, right? We're all going to go to class. We're all going to learn English 9. We're all going to do it together. And if you can't quite mm-hmm. do it, then we're going to send you off to these pods.
Well, I think it's an exercise in mediocrity.
Mm-hmm.
And making everybody the same, which we shouldn't be. Because I remember in one program, we celebrated the uniqueness of everyone because everybody is unique just like everybody else.
Right.
And which is kind of an oxymoron, but it's also very true. And the one thing that I want to point out about this book, because I love this book.
It's great.
I thought this book was wonderful. is that I love his ideas. I would love to be able to do a school that doesn't have grades, where the students can be promoted or move up as far and do their own schedule of learning to figure out what it is that they need, where they need it, and take them from there and create portfolios that take them. And I know that there are schools that do that. I want to say that Evergreen State College did that, but I'm not positive. Hmm. And but I believe that they're closed now. But there are, I believe that there are experimental places that can do that. And I think that he has a lot of the right ideas. It's how do we do that? Because people are so complacent and they're terrified of change. Teachers especially are change. They say, we need to change. And then when you present them with change, they say, not yet, not yet, not yet. I'm not ready to change. Wait till I retire. And this is going on and on and on. So, yeah.
Isn't that kind of like your basic, like you stick with the herd, because if you're that one lone gazelle that leaves the herd to do something different, you don't last long. So you stay with the herd, right? Like it's kind of, it's hard to do change because it's just kind of ingrained in our, you know, our DNA or what's the word I'm looking for? Like our, the way the...
You need to conform.
Right. You safety in numbers. You stick with the herd.
Right. And I am not a person who conforms. Right, Philip?
No.
No. And, you know, and it doesn't bother me that people look at me askance, because I know that what I'm doing is right for my students. And if I'm too comfortable, I know that my curriculum isn't evolving. I know my students aren't evolving. I know that I'm not looking out for their best interest. I'm looking out for whatever is easiest for me. And that's not necessarily what's best.
Right.
So, and I think that's what it boils down to. How do we best serve our students? And does that mean, I have an exercise that my students are going to do. And for our listeners, this is our first week back. And we haven't met with students. I still have 2 days before I meet with my students, but I have them sitting down to create their own school. And they're going to have to use that as an exercise, and it's going to keep them busy, and they have to have a reason why they chose that way. But it also allows me to see what their thought process is. And it also opens up a discussion that I can have with them individually and also as a group. And it teaches me who I have and what different abilities I have and their expectations and what they would like to present.
That's so, really interesting, especially since, you know, we haven't been together in 580 some odd days.
That's so true.
Yeah.
It's a good way to, right? Let's revisit. That's a good one.
So, Philip, what's your take?
My take is that I see a big spin cycle going on, and it seems like it's kind of like the weatherman standing in front of this map going, and I see this circular storm coming, and it's just going around and around, and it keeps going around and around and around, and it doesn't seem to move forward. I like that take on there's no change happening. And when I first started my career, they'd say those things like, oh, this is just a retread of an old idea. And the old idea was, they're right. It's the old ideas is not big change. There needs to be grades disappearing and schedules rearranging and buildings being smaller and all kinds of changes that need to occur and tests that don't get taken to measure intelligence that can't be measured in things such as that. That's my take on that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's the same vehicle, different colors, different, it's the same platform. It's kind of like we are always going through a refresh cycle. And even the automobile industry knows that a refresh only lasts so long. And then you have to come up with new gadgets, new devices, and then when you release the new model, then you may have some kinks that and bugs that need to be worked out. You know, if you look at the Palisade, the um, not the Palisade. What's the name of the Pacifica? The Chrysler Pacifica, that has some major, major kinks that they can't figure out right now. And so it's kind of at a standstill. But it's a good vehicle. Just that one version of the model is out, but it's supposedly a very, very, very wonderful vehicle. It's just that it's dangerous and you have to park it away from the house and
awesome. New Coke.
I didn't know what you were talking about at first. I'm like, oh, cars. I'm talking about cars. It took me a second. I'm
cars.
Like,
what? it wasn't the Palisade. That's a Hyundai. But
Hyundai, so,
but you know, the automobile industry knows this. What?
Hyundai does not.
Hyundai
like
hates
you.
Me?
Yeah.
Yes, they do. So anyway, so let's wrap this up because, wow, we've been at this for a while. So if our listeners are interested in a good read, it's a bit dense. You can start highlighting and then reread it. And it's not a long, difficult read, but it's very thought-provoking, and it really makes you consider a great deal and makes you rethink how you're doing things. It is One Size Does Not Fit All by Nikhil Goyal. You can buy it at the Aero, the Alternative Education Research Organization website. If you go to the National Association for Alternative Ed, that's not right. National Alternative Education Association, I think it is. If you go to their site, and you will find Aero on there, and you can buy it through there, or you can buy it off of Amazon. And it's also available at Powell's Books and other booksellers. So just look for it online. So with that, I'm going to say adios until next time. Uh-huh. And thank you, Christy and Philip.
Thank you.
By Nikhil Goyal. You can buy it at the Aero, the Alternative Education Research Organization website. If you go to the National Association for Alternative Ed, that's not right. National Alternative Education Association, I think it is. If you go to their site, and you will find Aero on there, and you can buy it through there, or you can buy it off of Amazon, and it's also available at Powell's Books and other booksellers. So just look for it online. So with that, I'm going to say adios until next time. Uh-huh. And thank you, Christy and Philip.
Thank you.